Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 088.RV1703, certificate number 36297. The Babylon Working. That's not a sentence.
Mr. Mojo Rising? I guess the first thing for the far distant future to understand is that we're currently living in an odd era of inflection when it comes to religious belief.
I think the first thing that the far future needs to understand is that we used to think that time was linear.
And future existed.
Yeah, and so they're at a flat circle.
Our compatriots...
Who are
right now simultaneously listening on a different part of a four-dimensional solid we call time-space.
That's right. Hello, friends, neighbors,
I wish we could see you, but so far we don't have the tech. Perhaps you can see us, yeah. In which case, stop looking at us when we're going to the bathroom. We don't like it.
But after we establish that, a component of that.
An important component for today's entry in the Omnibus would be the odd state of religion at our current moment. This is a story set in the early to mid 20th century. And even here in the early 21st century, we're at a time where there's a huge chunk of the planet that thinks of religion as just a necessary benchmark for stable society and a life well-lived, like a minimum low bar, taken for granted as something that everyone needs and should want.
Do you have a statistic about how large that chunk is?
Well, it's difficult to poll. You know, when you ask, because asking people about do you consider yourself religious? Do you attend services? There's a whole lot of gray area there. You know, many people will generally believe in a higher power, but don't consider themselves religious. Many people will consider themselves religious, but have never been inside a church, synagogue, or mosque. You know,
what's the current status of China in terms of, I know this, there's no state religion, but like, are most people in China practicing?
Yeah, they're all Lutherans.
Some kind of Lutheranism?
No.
The global religion?
The majority do practice some kind of melange of Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism, which, you know, straddles many practices that would be considered I mean, along the lines of, you know, Western celebrations of Christmas, where it's a secular holiday with deep religious roots that are still there for many people. I think there's a broad variety of festivals and traditions in the Chinese life and calendar that
have
clear connections to religious forebears.
But you can also celebrate them as secular holidays.
Yeah, and they're moving into the realm of superstition as well. Well, of course I'm going to cut out yellow circles and place them on this altar once a year. This is the day where that gives gold to my uncle in the afterlife.
Of course.
Oh, you believe you're going to be with your uncle in the afterlife? Oh, Lord, no. You know, like it's. I mean, you know, you ask somebody on different days of the week and you're going to get different answers. There's a longitudinal study that I think gets done by Pew Research in America that asks people, do you believe in God? Do you attend services? Do you believe scripture to be the word of God? Do you believe in an afterlife? And those numbers, you can see pretty steady declines over the last 50 years in all except for afterlife. Afterlife belief has been rising.
That's telling.
I guess they all believe they're going to be uploaded to the cloud.
I don't really believe in a religion, but yes.
I don't like church or the Bible, but I am 100% going to heaven.
I've been thinking about this a lot because we're now, once again, embroiled in a kind of church and state separation argument in our nation.
Yes.
And you and I lived through most of our childhood during a time when institutional promotion of religion was on the wane. Mm-hmm. Charlie Brown no longer appeared on television, you know, kneeling in front of a star.
He did every year, but we started to see it as an odd throwback and source possibly of a comedic trope.
And a lot of this was really driven by a desire, you know, by a conviction that we needed to exorcise religion.
I thought you were going to say Satan, but
we needed to exorcise
first,
Satan,
get Satan out of Reagan,
and then religion as a whole, and it, you know, we all accepted it as an article of faith. Like we need,
this is a good pluralistic society. This is how school will be. And it's weird if there's prayer,
no prayer. And then the other day I was thinking, wait a minute, we did it completely backwards.
How do you mean?
Well, the Netherlands, for instance, are one of the countries that reports the least number, you know, the least amount of sort of religiosity. Mm-hmm. Yet they celebrate every single holiday.
It's like China.
Absolutely.
They kept all the festivities.
Every saint, every single time someone in the Christian calendar stubbed their toe, there's a day off from work.
Don't forget to wear some weird, this piece of jewelry of a weird color. It's St. Agnetha's Day.
It's absolutely genius because they have like 90 more holidays than we do. And I was thinking—
Plus the merchandising.
Yeah. In our pluralistic society, with religions from around the world, we could have 200 days a year off from work. If we just said no, we are celebrating every holiday equally. Every single holiday is the same as Christmas.
Like you would have Diwali and Ramadan stuff in the dollar store.
100%. And I mean, it'd basically be every other Monday off.
We did it the wrong way. Even for religion, we got and for secularists, we got rid of all the fun decorations,
right,
and foodstuffs. But we still have the culture war and the xenophobia and all the downsides of religion.
Yeah, we drove all the mainstream Christians underground and made them feel persecuted.
And made them join school boards. They had no other choice.
And we lost all the holidays. Oh, it's so infuriating.
And even when it comes back, they're going to be like, oh no, we won't have Halloween parties in this elementary school in Georgia. They're not going to want to have the parties of religious origins because they're no fun.
Yeah, in 1979, we could have said, okay, you get prayer in schools, but we get equal time to do Halloween prayers in schools. Like we get equal. We're going to have, you know, every day we're going to pray to Mecca like six times a day.
Have you been following all the malicious compliance related to some of these new religious laws?
No.
You know, Florida says, here's the new series of things you can't say in school, you know,
right.
And now, you know, atheist groups are going to start suing to say, hey, this teacher said he was a man and the law is written to say you can't talk about your gender.
Oh, that's well,
yeah,
funny.
but he's a cis man. Yeah, but read the law. You know?
Lol.
Or people who, you know, or all the book banning laws, generally, no matter how they're written, would tend to ban the Bible.
Right, of course, it's full of rape.
So you get a lot of these petitions saying, hey, no book has more violence and sexual no-nos than the Bible. So
all of this is backwards. We should have been the entire time saying every crazy religion gets equal time in schools. It would be 2 hours a day just praying, but to a pantheon of gods.
Do you think people would get bored? All right, everybody turn and face east. Now we're doing Mecca. All right, everybody turn and face this picture of the horned satanic god Baphomet.
Are you saying that kids aren't bored in school as it stands?
I guess this way, maybe you'd at least be doing different postures.
Well, and think about it. We
press the physical fitness test because of all the kneeling.
We put such a premium on cultural exchange. What better groundwork to cultural exchange than to learn the intricacies of every single religion?
I think that's a non-starter for people of almost all religions who all agree on one thing. There is one religion that should be in the public sphere. They can't agree on which one it is, unfortunately. If they could just get together on that and be like, we've decided it's Zoroastrianism, it's Eastern Orthodox.
I love this. Every religion gets 10 minutes right up front at the top of the school day.
It's like the equal time laws on the airwaves.
Exactly.
Hey, I'm sorry. We just said a Judeo-Christian prayer. So now.
And now here comes a dragon parade.
Here's a laughing Buddha, gold statue of laughing Buddha we're rolling in. It just came from the third grade class. They just finished. You'd have to have a rotating system of iconography all day through the school
and
halls.
Then here comes Anton LaVey and he's waving some flags.
So we're at this weird time where, you know, a huge chunk of society thinks the main problem is that there's not enough religion, and in fact that they are personally being threatened as religious people.
We do see that.
You've got incorrectly, perhaps, but yes. you've got another huge chunk of society that perceives religion as the source of all evil and something to be extirpated from the public sphere.
Sure, I've met a few of those people.
And then you've got kind of a soggy middle that, you know, of the America we grew up with where religion's good as long as it's on its best behavior.
Yeah, the soggy middle.
There are certain kinds of religion that demonstrate a sufficient amount of decorum that we're going to let it slide.
That's right. Keep it tight.
Stop. No snake handling. No ululating. No loudspeakers at dawn from towers. All that's a little extra.
If you have a building and it has a pointy part, and one day a week.
Yeah, a tasteful number of days a week, one.
One day a week, or two, maybe like a Wednesday night. Everybody is in there for an hour.
The music has to be of a type that was fashionable a few decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so even if you're in a mega church that has some nice Christian rock, it's going to be extremely tasteful AM gold.
You can absolutely wear a costume on that one day a week. No matter, I mean, every religion's got it, right? So you wear your costume.
You might have one guy in front with a costume. It's a little weird if everybody, you can wear one item.
Yeah, I mean, let's say it's a fancy hat, right?
Yes.
Church hat.
You got a little skull cap. Yeah. You're
turban.
You're a fancy, an African-American lady with a flowered hat.
Or a clip-on tie and a short sleeve white shirt.
Sure.
Whatever your uniform is, whatever your crazy... Your crazy costume, pocket protector,
but take
and
it down
black shoes.
You have to be like the guy at the Halloween party that obviously is not trying.
Right.
Because if you really show up in going all out religious expression, we're in a time where, you know, the 20th century was a time of saying, no.
Yeah, you're right.
Can you dial it back
a
little?
Yeah, no like tie gold headdress that's 3 feet tall.
Not one of those pyramidal gold hats from pagan Central Europe that we put in the omnibus once.
I remember those days so well where it felt like it wasn't just that extremism was in decline, but that, yeah, there was a golden mean where everybody was just... I mean, I don't think there's a better word than soggy middle.
There's not a lot of, religion, yeah, you do you. Like, there really is like... I have opinions now about your religious practice. It's either too much or too little, and we lost this broad... Well, I don't know whether it was good or not, but we did have a broad sense that there was a tasteful amount of religious expression.
Yeah, and if you want to go more, do it at home.
Yeah, it's not, know, like, none of my business.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want
at home. Please don't be yelling at your city council about it.
Right.
And this story takes place in the largely in the 1930s and 40s, and it kind of covers a time when there was well-behaved religion, and then there was the kind of religion that nobody would approve of, and an unusual intersection of the Venn diagram of how that interacted with science and with academia and with government and with cities, and how it really in retrospect, it's an extremely surprising story because of the oddball at the center of it.
I'm always coming from the North, my relationship to evangelicalism was always that it was not acceptable, not considered mainstream in the North, but very mainstream in the South. And that where that mainstream line was always, I remember the first kind of like apocalyptic Christian church that opened in Anchorage that was a big deal. And it was, it felt like the equivalent of a church from a foreign country that had.
It was like the Rajneesh had moved in.
Yeah, like, wow, what? We actually would drive by the church on Sundays and kind of look, trying to see if they were handling snakes.
Had there been enough migration from that part of the country to Anchorage for oil jobs or whatever?
It became a huge church. It was a massive success.
In Alaska, that's what, 8 people.
Well, no, I mean, it was the first like mega temple any of us had seen. The parking lot was full of cars, and it just felt like
American cars.
It felt, well, there weren't any other kinds then. It felt like something very exotic, very exotic. And then it became, of course, the biggest church in town, and it was what everybody was talking about.
I'm going to get more exotic here than evangelical or even fundamentalist Christianity. I'm going to take you to the Church of Thelema, the Agape Lodge, the Ordo Templo Orientis, the weird traditions.
This is all some Masonic talk.
Western esotericism, the same root as Masonic and similar orders, because it all revolves around the idea of secret knowledge, hidden knowledge, certain texts that not everyone has, but we have the secrets, and wouldn't it be great to know the secret of life?
Are you going
to
walk on my good Templars topic?
Are you meaning to do?
You're
pro-Templars?
No. The good Templars are a kind of Templar that I've got on my short list, but it doesn't sound like we're going to talk
about that. No. I mean, the Knights of Templar are a more heavily Christianized society than most of these mystical traditions that we're going to be discussing.
Oh, okay.
The Rosicrucians, for example, the Hermetics, you know, the people who believe that Thoth and Hermes were the same god. When, you know, you go to Greece, you go to Egypt, you know, they call you something different.
Sure. I don't see how you could argue that.
When I go to Japan, they all call me, Ken actually is a Japanese name. This is a terrible example.
Kenji.
Never mind. And Thoth Hermes delivered all these secret texts. It goes back to Gnosticism and Kabbalah. But in the 20th century, it overlapped with, science and academia and even the space program, aerospace.
And there was a space program in the early 20th century? There are a lot of secrets in this episode.
We are going back to the very beginning, the proto-space race. We're going back to a time when rocketry was a brand new science. 1926. Like, isn't it crazy that rocketry is less than a century old?
I love it. There were fireworks.
Sure. The Chinese had, many cultures, beginning in ancient China, had known, you know, as soon as you can invent gunpowder, you realize you can blow something up, and then you realize when you blow something up, you literally blow it up.
Yes.
The up becomes the operative word. But the fact that you could do controlled launches and get controlled thrust with the right fuel, that all dates back to Robert Goddard in I think 1926.
Yeah.
And for many, you know, for decades before that, even for some years after that, there was kind of a widespread belief, even in the scientific community, that this was not just not practicable, but like not physically impossible, really, that the laws of physics would not allow this kind of propulsion to do any work. And in fact, all the Jules Verne stuff was going to stay science fiction forever.
You just couldn't get enough thrust.
You couldn't get enough thrust. And maybe even the, in some circles, like misunderstanding the basic Newtonian laws, like, no, you cannot eject thrust into a vacuum. There's nothing to push on, and therefore the rocket will not work. I think many, the New York Times famously had to run a correction in July 1969 saying, we regret saying in 1926 to Robert Goddard that rockets were a dead end and man will never walk on the moon. You know, it took, you know, it's kind of tongue in cheek, but
right.
It took them 40 years to walk it back.
But had they never taken a balloon and tried to make a fart sound with it and then let it go?
When scientists see a balloon, all they want to do is rub it on their hair and stick it to something.
Oh, I see.
The compulsion is just too strong. A cat, if possible. The hero of our story, well, the protagonist, I don't want to say hero, is Jack Parsons, who was born in 1914.
Sounds like a fake name.
In Los Angeles County. Jack Parsons is, in fact, his fake name. His parents called him Jack because they did not want to confuse him with his father of the same name. So he missed out on the chance to be known as Marvel Whiteside Parsons.
Marvel Whiteside Parsons, too.
Can you imagine being named Marvel Whiteside Parsons the second and going by Jack?
Jack Parsons. I don't know. Marvel Parsons?
Especially given the kind of life we read that he has.
Marvel Parsons sounds like you've got a mouthful of marbles.
Marvel Parsons sounds like a hee-haw character. But when you break it down, it's perfect. It's got the religious angle of the parson, but also the Gnostic wonder of the marveling.
Marvel?
Yeah. And the comic book and pulp tradition, which was a big part of Jack's childhood. He grew up on what is no longer called Millionaire's Row in I don't know how well you know Pasadena, but kind of west of downtown Pasadena.
I know Pasadena like the back of my hand.
Well, the moneyed people in the 20s lived along this particular stretch of Orange Grove Boulevard that came to be called Millionaire's Row. And at that time, I believe Pasadena had more millionaires per capita or per square mile than anywhere else in America. Money was flowing west, and these were the guys whose names were in the pharmaceutical firms or the parts factories or the produce shipment companies or whatever it was.
Isn't that amazing to consider? Every time I'm in that town, I try to picture, like, how did Pasadena, right? Like looking at it in relation to LA now, it feels anomalous, but at the time it would have been like a little paradise. That bridge, that little cityscape.
It's pretty great. And it still has the Rose Bowl as kind of a remnant of a time when it was a real cultural center, not just in Southern California, but, you know, America wide. Pasadena was a nice neighborhood on the grow.
And they gave us Van Halen above all other things.
Oh, wow. I was going to go Rose Bowl and Caltech, but no, Van Halen. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, thank you.
Is Eddie Van Halen from Pasadena?
I think they all.
They all are?
Pasadena.
What about Sammy Hagar?
Oh, no. Sammy Hagar is from the swamps.
Sammy Hagar is a cryptid who wandered out of the Sierra Nevadas. The money appears to mostly have been his mom's family money, because by the time Jack is even an infant, like by the time he turns two, I think his parents have had a very acrimonious breakup. Dad has been found consorting with... today we would say sex workers, and we would support him, except that he did not have...
We would support them, not necessarily him.
Exactly, because he did not have the consent of his partner, and she was mad. And
I see.
And it became a nasty divorce. Dad moved out. Luckily, mom's family had the money. So Jack grew up in a lovely house on Millionaire's Row, where his obsession was... he had two obsessions. He loved science fiction. He loved his old Jules Verne books about being able to just cannonball a capsule full of people to the moon and what they might find there. He loved the pulp magazines that had just started, Amazing Stories and the other kind of the beginnings of American science fiction. Green Bug-Eyed Aliens, rockets, you know, all the post-Robert Goddard stuff about rocketry. And as a result, he started toying with rocketry.
What was his second obsession?
His second obsession was Satan. By the time he was 12 years old, Jack's apparently enough trouble that he's been sent off to some kind of military academy for boys who can't stop touching themselves or whatever it was called, where he spends most of his time apparently, you know, because even at home, he loved taking apart firecrackers to see what one could do with them.
And we are not saying, just to be clear, that if you are really into superheroes and Satan, that you're necessarily a masturbator.
No.
Okay.
No. In fact, I can't think that there would be any overlap at all.
Okay, all right. Just wanted to make that clear.
Although, weirdly, you know, his personal private time with his private parts actually becomes the center of this story later on, which I think has never been true of an omnibus entry before. Uh-huh. No one was ever touching themselves while the Halifax explosion happened that we know of.
No, although there are several entries where it feels like it might be a tangential part of the story, it's never been right at the heart of it.
We've always swerved away, I think. Yeah. Correctly. Yeah. Correctly. So yeah, content warning. He spends most of his time at military academy, apparently, you know, blowing up cherry bombs in the restroom toilets. Mm. Just, you know, Bart Simpson stuff.
Sure.
But also, at the same age, he is experimenting with mystical traditions enough that he tries to conjure up Satan in his childhood bedroom. And in fact, whatever happens, you know, it scares him so badly that he doesn't mess with the occult again.
Really?
Yeah, for decades.
But he got spooked.
He has a formative experience with his attempts to bring the big red guy to his childhood bedroom. But as he grows up, you know, his fascination with space and with blowing things up remains a constant. Unfortunately, the Great Depression means that his family's fortunes are on the wane. Despite being one of the smartest kids in his school, he gets into Stanford. He can't attend any of the, even back then, when I'm sure Stanford is, you know, 1/1000th the adjusted price it is today, he winds up at some Pasadena junior college, and in fact is forced to even drop out from that in the 30s. But he and some friends are still blowing things up, and they're getting more and more serious about it. Like, they're starting to realize the actual contours of the scientific problems involved. You know, how do you, what fuel will generate enough thrust and, crucially, over a long enough period of time? Because he's not just interested. He's getting to a point where he doesn't just want to see things blow up or fly in the air. He's wondering, how does this lead to space travel? How does this lead to amazing stories?
See, this is where our paths diverged, because I blew up a lot of stuff, but I never got serious about it.
Well, you were at an age where there were already pretty good rockets. You know, you realized you were competing with NASA.
Do you remember what Whistling Petes were? Did you ever have a Whistling
Pete? We called them Piccolo Petes.
Piccolo Petes.
But yeah, I know exactly what they're.
A Whistling Pete, I learned this in about 1977. If you took a pair of pliers and you crimped it, you could get the Whistling Pete to both fly and explode.
In that order, I assume.
Yeah. And it was a great evolution because, you know, Whistling Pete was one of the safe and sane fireworks.
I mean, that's why I know about them, because I grew up in Washington State was safe and sane at
the
time.
Safe and sane.
So you had to just watch those little snake things uncoil or watch something sit on the ground and spin, and that's the only options.
But one of the great things about safe and sane fireworks is they gave you an opportunity to see if you could mod them to make them unsafe and insane. And there were a few you could.
I mean, it's right there in the name.
Yeah.
When you say, hey, let's buy something for 4th of July, let's buy something that's safe and sane, every child immediately thinks, well, hold on. That doesn't seem like the most fun thing we could do, right?
What would happen if I put it under a bucket? What would happen if I put it in a phone booth?
Exactly. And a lot of these kids blew off fingers, and we should hasten to add that,
Omnibus is against blowing off fingers.
Yes. We're against the behaviors that might even lead to blowing off your fingers. So Jack and some of his friends, his hobbyist friends, are really getting serious about this problem to the degree that they're starting to think about things like multi-stage rockets and are liquid fuels really the right way to go? You know, like, they're so unstable. Is there a way to make in the same way that you can stabilize nitroglycerin by putting it in dynamite, if I'm getting that right, you know, like, what's the equivalent? Are there solid rocket fuels that are really the future? And at the age of 23, he actually convinces the California Institute of Technology in his Pasadena hometown to host and sponsor his little rocket club, his group of 20-something-year-old young men who are blowing things up.
It's the proto Cub Scouts. They're having a rocketry match. Did you do model rockets as a kid?
I never got beyond those water rockets,
which
I loved. But no, as an adult, I've helped out with a local Boy Scout troop that was actually shooting things in the air with explosives.
In the 70s, model rocketry was a really big deal, and I built many model rockets and launched them.
And what happens? They've got little. Do they have the chutes in the capsule?
Yep, and some of them were multi-stage, rockets. The Estes company kind of made a whole set of different sizes of rockets. You could build you know, launchable Saturn V. I started off with the little rockets that were, what, 16 inches tall?
Yeah.
And then, and went up from there. It was a real, it was a real activity. I went to some rocketry events that had 500 kids, and rockets were up in the sky all day.
It was just a thrill.
Yeah, it was.
Do you remember as a kid just seeing something flying? It's a pre-drone world, but you see the Goodyear blimp above a stadium, or you see, I think occasionally I'd see hot air balloons or something, and you just couldn't believe you were seeing it.
Hot air balloons were big in Anchorage, so we saw them a lot. And they were big in Salt Lake.
Yeah, and here on the east side is where I remember seeing.
Yeah.
I think they still launch them from Woodinville, maybe?
We talked about doing hot air balloons on Omnibus, and I'm going to make a note that that will be the next episode.
Let the record show John is typing in his phone.
Maybe not the next episode.
Presumably hot air balloons.
Some episode at some point.
So Jack and his high school friend, his grade school friend, I think, Ed Foreman, somehow talk Caltech into letting them use the resources of the Guggenheim Aeronautical Laboratory, or GALSIT, which was kind of Caltech's budding aerospace department.
So what were they doing at the aeronautical laboratory at that time?
Well,
building a better biplane?
Once Ed and Jack, I'm sure it's aerofoil shapes and you know, testing different kinds of wing shapes in wind tunnels. But once Jack and Ed get there, suddenly they have the GALSIT Rocket Research Group.
So these guys don't have college degrees. They're just local enthusiasts.
Dropouts. And they quickly come to be called the Suicide Squad at Caltech. The Rocket Research Group is called the Suicide Squad, mostly because fully a quarter of their budget every year is going to building repair because they're experimenting with explosives full time. In the fairly sophisticated and, as we now know, correct belief that this is the future of aerospace. This is the future of air travel and space travel.
Did they have like a cool old hearse that they drove around Pasadena in?
So there has been a, I didn't know this one. This was a show requested by a listener named Russell. And I've long been interested in the story of Jack Parsons and what's going to happen to him and his famous friends. And I did not know that, like, as of a couple of years ago, there's actually one of these period TV dramas that sprang up in the wake of Mad Men. You know, anti-heroes out of time, like the one they made about Masters and Johnson, or the one they made about, there's actually a show called, I think, Strange Angel, fictionalized about Jack Parsons' adventures in the 30s and 40s, because he was apparently kind of a dapper, debonair character around the Caltech campus. Many articles about him today refer to him as the James Dean of Chemistry, or the James Dean of Caltech.
Whoa.
Which doesn't take much at Caltech. Also, it's anachronistic. Parsons actually passes away before James Dean's first starring role. So nobody was calling him that at the time, but in hindsight, he was that kind of a louche bad boy character.
I feel like Strange Angel sounds like a vampire TV show and they just got the title wrong. I would never watch a TV show called Strange Angel, but I would absolutely watch a TV show called the James Dean of Caltech.
To me, Strange Angel really conveys well that it's going to happen at the intersection of crazy UFO stuff and crazy occult stuff.
Yeah.
Which is what's going to happen. Spoilers.
Oh.
So I don't know if the TV show was on some channel that doesn't maybe exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sounds likely.
Whatever CBS's equivalent of Peacock is, except they don't have a fun animal. So theirs is called Big Yellow Eye or something.
Maybe it was Google Plus.
My guess is it got folded into Paramount Plus, but I'm not going to research any of this because who cares?
Who cares?
Streaming is collapsing. There's no way the show is going to be renewed for whatever season it's not on yet. Let's pretend it doesn't exist.
Some futureling right now is shouting into their headphones.
So angry. Season two was an improvement on season one, and the producers say that they've got a 5-year plan and they're going to go to...
It's also possible that one of the writers or producers is actually listening to, and they're just hanging their head and one solitary tear dripping down.
That's not impossible. Let's say, and we're going to do a very cursory treatment of a subject that I'm sure they've researched and fictionalized in depth. So let's say if you're listening, actually, the show's probably good.
Oh, yeah.
And we just haven't... too much TV, peak TV. I'm sorry.
It's wonderful, and you should download it all immediately.
I haven't even watched the good shows I want to watch. I have no time to watch the good shows I don't want to watch. You know how it is.
Absolutely. It took me a second to parse that, but yes.
The funny thing about the Rocket Research Group or Suicide Squad is they're in exactly the right place at the right time, and soon they are starting to get... hefty military contracts for their work. Not for rocketry. This is still the 30s, and nobody's worried about missiles raining down on European capitals yet.
Right.
What they want is airplanes that take off faster. they want jet engines to get airplanes off the ground. The military correctly sees that this is the future of fighter planes.
Well, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio taught us that you just need to sand down the heads of those rivets.
If the rivets stick out, you'll never get anywhere.
How fast can you go?
I thought you were going to say Leonardo da Vinci. I was picturing the flapping wings made of balsa wood or whatever he had. Because you also need to sand down the rivets on those, probably.
You do.
But they're made of balsa wood, so it's easier to sand. So Jack Parsons is going places. Now, at the same time, we kind of have to follow the parallel threads of science and religion here. At the same time here, he is starting to make some friends over the hill in Hollywood. Hollyweird, I call it.
Yeah.
Because he's starting to hang out with, people more on the fringes of society than he would have met in well-heeled Pasadena Millionaires Row. He's starting to meet actors.
This is starting to sound like a noir.
And, well, I mean, he's not going to deal with, you know, people shipping moonshine into Long Beach.
But is he hanging out with Fatty Arbuckle? Are they, like, murdering starlets? Like,
he's hanging out with actors like John Carradine, early gay rights activists, the kind of thing that you're more likely to see in Hollywood at the time than in Pasadena. And a lot of these people are interested in the then faddish ideas of Aleister Crowley.
I thought it was Crowley.
I believe it's Crowley.
Whoa.
And I'm going to let somebody in the writer's room of Strange Angel can write in and correct one of us.
I need to call Ozzy because Ozzy. He is going to have, this is going to affect his catalog.
Do you feel like he says Crowley?
Mr. Crowley.
He's got a mouthful of bat.
Bow, bow, bow.
He's got a mouthful of flying mammal. You can't tell the vowels.
It's true.
Mr. Crowley. I'm sorry. I need to swallow this bat.
But yeah, I think within heavy metal, Aleister, and I'm incapable of saying Crowley or whatever, however you just said it, Aleister Crowley plays a large role in 70s and 80s metal.
Yes. He is kind of the nexus point from which all of these 20th century traditions come. You know, he was interested in all the Western esotericism of the past and coupled that with his own set of visions and texts. You know, to create, he's pretty much the ancestor of every neo-pagan movement of the 20th century. Wicca, chaos magic, the Church of Satan to some degree.
He bought a castle somewhere that had ghosts, right?
He came from money. So he's a British guy from a wealthy Warwickshire family. He has better castle access than you or I will ever have.
Agreed.
And at the time that Parsons first sees his work, among LA weirdos, they love his, he's still alive, Crowley, I think. Now I'm not going to know. Still alive and very excited about the American spinoffs of his world religious organization. Jack Parsons attends a Gnostic mass that's being held at Crowley's Church of Thelema. Thelema is a sketchy word nominally from Koine Greek, meaning will, like as in
a will to power,
the human will. Yes. Uh-huh. Because that was kind of Crowley's famous, his one ethical credo, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Right.
In other words,
Aleister Crowley.
Yeah.
Crowley.
No, I believe it's Aleister Crowley.
Do what thou wilt. That shall be the whole of the law.
Yeah. It's kind of a Nietzschean, you know, it doesn't mean, I'm sure he would, at the time, he never would have said, you know, go do some ritual murders. But he is saying, you know, a lot of these hidebound religious ideas are just holding us back. We need a freer mind, and we need to free our minds and our love. And the perfect world is one in which we all live in harmony because everybody can do what their inner voice tells them.
Yeah, it's Nietzschean, it's anarchic, or it's John Galtian. Right, it's right at the intersection. Yeah.
And actually, libertarianism is an interesting data point here because of the kinds of people in West Coast science at this time that Parsons is going to end up hanging out with. I think that's a lot of the reason for the current coalition behind Randi and Thought Today would be very shocked at the cultural currents that led to its founding.
Hmm.
The Church of Thelema, this organization is often called the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis. That was Crowley's order of Eastern Templars. Crowley started out as a kind of a synthesis of Gnosticism and Kabbalah and all these Western mystical esoteric secret traditions, secret knowledge handed down from the old ones. But he soon started to mingle it with Eastern ideas of, you know, not just Buddhism, but different kinds of Hindu and yoga, yogi ideas. And it goes back to other Western traditions, alchemy and astrology and the tarot, and it's all a cosmic gumbo for him.
A cosmic gumbo.
And Parsons is super interested in it. It really speaks to him. He's, you know, his occult interests as a kid overlap with his scientific ones in that they're both amazing stories. You know, they're both getting beyond this world to a new one where there's new wise entities we don't know about. And to Crowley, those are the old gods. And to Parsons, maybe they're Martians. But this is the beginning of the era where those two things start to dovetail. And Jack Parsons is really kind of the epicenter of how that happens. You know, what if the aliens are the mystic old ones or the fairies that spoke to our ancestors?
It feels almost like a like a weird roll of the dice here, because we think, certainly from our soggy middle sense of mid-century American science, that science and superstition are antithetical to one another, and that the scientific mind progresses away from the occult. But really, it just depends on who's standing there holding the wrench, right?
How far back you look.
Yeah,
you know, right. From our point of view, clearly Newton was correct about mechanics, but a dope about alchemy. But he didn't know that. Like at the time, those were both sciences,
right?
And I think that's how Parsons sees it. You know, like, this is a new way of seeing the universe, and we're going to see how these laws all how Crowley's pronouncements all tie into scientific law.
I've been trying to explain string theory to my 11-year-old.
That's a religion.
In a very, very, the most basic way. And watching her face as I, like, just sort of try and break it down and make it understandable, which it's clearly not. But watching her face and all of the, like, the different expressions of incredulity that go across it as I'm like, well, so the math says.
If you tell it, there's 22 dimensions. Yeah. And super strings resonating at different frequencies are what divides them. I mean, that's no different than telling someone the kingdom of God has a gate of jasper and onyx.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. And let's be honest, one thing that really appeals to Parsons about the Gnostic mass is the kind of crazy, ahead of their time, sex rites
that are going on there. That really always does play a key role, or at least it used to. Nowadays, I don't see as much science driven by crazy sex rites.
No, because you got three sex rite apps on your phone. You know, at all times, you don't need to find some new religious movement.
It's
right?
going to be the next hipster thing
to find or found a new religious
human sacrifice.
He is very into. This is probably a record for how long it's taken Anonymous to turn into the inevitable sex cult. But Jack Parsons and his wife Helen join a sex cult. They love all the partner swapping, or at least Jack does. There's some evidence that Helen is not against it also. By now we're in the mid-40s, and Jack Parsons is really at his career peak. He's had a real breakthrough in turning liquid rocket fuels into solids. He's actually inspired by Greek fire, which has been an omnibus entry, to use asphalt as a binding agent. And he finds that he's having great luck using asphalt as the stabilizer for his rocket fuel. So he's blowing up fewer buildings at Caltech. The Suicide Squad, the rocket research group, has been renamed Jet Propulsion Laboratories on the strength of their massive Army contract. The Army, he's also started up kind of a quasi-related group called Aerojet, which is going to produce new jet engines for Army, you know, new rocketry for Army planes, basically the beginning of the jet age. And he has accidentally founded Jet Propulsion Laboratories. The initials JPL, coincidentally, could be Jack Parsons Laboratories. It would not exist without him.
It's really the sex cult that keeps him off of the $1 bill.
That is what starts to happen, because from this career point, high point, it goes downhill. Not at first. There's some sexual shenanigans. He has a great disappointment when his wife, Helen, falls for the leader of their Thelemic Lodge, the Agape Lodge, a man named Wilfred Smith. And this is, if we imagine that Jack is the one who dragged his wife to all the sex rites, it is kind of funny to imagine that
We don't know that, though. She might have been the one that was like, come on, Jack, take me to the sex party. And he's like, ah, oh, I'm working on the jets.
I've got this stuff. I still haven't cleaned my purple robes from
Jack,
last week.
Come on.
The sex rite starts at 8.
Get your purple robes on.
Well, certainly that's what happens when she falls for Wilfred Smith, the charismatic leader of the lodge. Mm. Jack, we're going to be late for the sex lodge. Why are you so into going to the sex lodge this week? Last week, you just wanted to listen to Jack Benny.
No, Wilfred has a lot to tell us this week about.
Exactly.
About me going to him.
I like to imagine a world where Jack is kind of a lousy 40s husband who drags his wife to all these wife-swapping things and feeds her a line about how this is the future of freeing your mind and your thalamic soul,
mm-hmm.
and then she leaves him for the better looking leader of the group.
That's the fictionalized account in your version of this.
Because he has a more potent wand, ceremonial wand,
right?
But Jack gets in. I don't want to say this is a retaliation. But
he builds a rocket 10 stories tall.
He begins having sex with his rockets. No, actually, he begins an affair with Helen's 17-year-old half-sister, Betty.
Hmm.
So again, you know, this is the reasoning for, you know, my not wanting Jack to come off so well in this story.
Yeah, right.
Because sure. This is his move. You're into the wand guy? Well, guess what? Your sister is just a younger version of you.
She's into the rocket guy.
But they all make it work.
They all make it work.
Who knows on the inside who is being dragged into this and who is enthusiastic?
I was going to say this sounded really 15th century, but if they all made it work, it's sounding very 21st century.
What if they
century?
All move into a nice craftsman in Pasadena, which they call the Pasadena Lodge?
They all got matching tattoos.
Jack, his wife, her wand guy, you know, the lodge leader, and her... Her perky half sister.
Wait, you're saying this happened?
Yes, they all move into the new relocated Agape Lodge, and suddenly Jack is now living on site at the center of Los Angeles Thelemic Crowley worship.
With his wife.
With his wife.
Who is sleeping with the temple lodge leader and her half sister, who's a teenager.
Yes. And at the same time, he is founding JPL and trying to deliver thousands of jet engines to the Army Air Corps.
You're basically describing the early years of the Joko Cruise.
I thought you were going to say Van Halen.
Also Van Halen. It all links up.
This is where a young David Lee Roth enters the picture. No, we are still in the mid-40s. Unfortunately, as you're saying, this is the kind of thing that does tend to work against somebody professionally, right? When the scientific part of their life cannot always compete with the purple robes.
Unlike in 2022, where polyamory really helps. If you come out as polyamorous and living in a cult house, it propels your career.
So many people on social media will be cheerleading your bravery. In fact, he's now a habitual user of amphetamines, because he's a science man of the 40s.
Right, that was the times.
Coke and amphetamines, but also peyote and mescaline, because he's a Satan worshiper of the 40s.
Whoa!
So this guy's got it all going on. He's in, you know, it's starting to be, and it's becoming visible at work, that his odd black magic cult is starting to lead to drug paranoia and hangovers.
Sure, he's snorting ketamine at his desk and working on moon rockets.
I think the noisy, the kind of the loud raucous neighbors start to complain about the velvet robes and the braziers of fire and the wands going into cups that they keep hearing next door at the Thelemic Agape Lodge.
Sure.
So there's a series. Now there becomes a series of police investigations of exactly what kind of religious organization he's running. And of course, this is now a guy with army military contracts who has to insist to law enforcement that no, nothing weird anymore, that we just are interested in philosophical explorations here at our little study group.
We're just wearing these purple robes to stay warm.
Of course, my wife has nothing on under the purple robe, but that's because you showed up in such a hurry.
It's a breeze in off the desert.
And his reputation becomes such that he is essentially forced out of JPL. He is bought out. He gets $11,000 in stock.
Not that much.
And even at the time, not that great for founding the modern jet science.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
So they didn't smear him as a communist, which would be the lowest common denominator here.
That comes later.
Okay.
We need to wait for the late 40s, early 50s for Black Magic Sex Cult to equal. And clearly you're a Marxist Leninist. That's coming too. At the time, it was a simpler time, John. You could be in a Black Magic Sex Cult without also being in a, without worrying if it was compatible with Marxism.
What's interesting is you could be a Marxist-Leninist at the time without interfering with your military contracts too.
Today, of course, all the polyamorists on the internet are also Marxist-Leninists, but they do not have big money military. They do not have fat military contracts for the most part.
Right, although that may be changing with the war in Ukraine.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That's true. Now that the specter of global thermonuclear war is being eagerly embraced by many good liberals.
Well, and how? I mean, we know Elon Musk is polyamorous. Is he also a Satanist?
Is Elon? Yeah, who is Elon Musk conjuring?
There's got to be some cauldron
this is a guy who has never. I feel like he has never looked heavenward and aspired to blowing something up or creating a portal that'll bring the old gods in. He just wants a car that will fart when you do the secret series of keystrokes.
Didn't he launch a Corvette into space?
He did.
So that feels like a holy rite.
I don't know.
He put it off as a gag, but I think he was sending the Corvette to his gods.
I guess you could believe that whatever our spirit of the age is, it's embodied now in automotive technology. This is the premise of My Mother, the Car. Also,
it was it's like a ritual sacrifice.
Exactly. You don't slaughter a goat anymore. You slaughter a cow
or slaughter a Corvette.
Sorry. Yeah. I mean, speaking of which, one of the things the neighbors are complaining about is that this Pasadena craftsman, Wilfred, Jack, Helen, and Betty are all keeping their own livestock, which they're slaughtering not just to have meat, but to have warm blood for their eldritch rituals.
No.
Sure.
They're not actually doing it. This is just what the neighbors are saying, or are they actually doing it?
No, they are, in fact, slaughtering the cows, eating the delicious steaks, because they're 1940s Americans.
And drinking the warm blood out of goblets.
But also saving the blood for Saturday night, yes.
Okay.
Also, not incidentally, this is going to come into the story. For many years, Jack and Helen have been friendly with the science fiction community, which is big in Southern California at the time. You know, this is so exciting for him, having grown up on Amazing Stories. He's now getting invited over to Robert Heinlein's house.
Also Weird Sex Cult.
Exactly. He's being invited over to Heinlein's house every week for the meeting of the Manana Literary Society, or whatever Heinlein calls it. You know, it's all the big names. Lee Brackett is there, and Elsbrigh de Camp is there, and Edmund Hamilton, all the California pulp sci-fi guys at the time. And Heinlein is starting to get his stories published in like the Saturday Evening Post and the Atlantic. And this is starting to turn legit. And I'm sure if you're Jack Parsons, you're so excited, you know, that your weird thing, you know, it would be the equivalent of a Pokemon fan from the old days suddenly seeing 100 million people playing.
But he's also the one that's doing science. It's not sci-fi. He's doing sci-ri.
Right. And I'm sure it's a feather in their cap that an actual jet propulsion rocket scientist is coming to their little meetings. And at one of these meetings, he meets a friend of Heinlein who, this is after the war, who, like Heinlein, is a mustachioed former wartime naval officer, full of all the maritime derring-do that comes with that.
Oh, boy, I see where this is going.
And also interested in pulp science fiction and is writing science fiction stories. This is...
Are you going to say it out loud? You know, there are bots that scan all podcasts.
Is there a code name we can use for Lafayette R.H., this science fiction author?
It's pronounced Lafayette Ron Hubbard.
Hubbard, as the French
Monsieur
would call him.
Monsieur Hubbard.
Le Ron Hubbard. What if we don't say...
The Church de Scientologie.
What if we agree to never say the D word of the self-help movement he is going to found?
All right.
And then we will also not say the S word of the global church that self-help movement morphs into. But we are allowed to say Mr. Hubbard's name. Do you think they'll come after us?
Obviously, we're talking about Ray Bradbury.
You know, young Ray Bradbury does show up at these meetings.
I bet he does.
So, but yes.
No, we're talking about outstanding American.
Patriotic American white sailor hat wearer. What's the name of the...
Sea Org.
What's the name of the Sea Org guy in the Paul Thomas Anderson movie, the Philip Seymour Hoffman character? In that movie, they call him...
Slightly fictionalized.
Lancaster Dodd.
Yeah, okay, let's call him Lancaster Dodd.
All right, mustachioed pulp sci-fi guy Lancaster Dodd is also at these meetings, and he immediately becomes... Parsons becomes fascinated with him because he's a charismatic figure. Unfortunately, Dodd. Damn it. Lancaster Dodd has his eye on Betty.
Oh.
His replacement.
Let's drop all pretense now. Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Having lost Helen to Wilfred Smith, he is now losing Betty to Lancaster Dodd. And so now they're all living together.
Is Betty 19 by now, or?
Let's see. Yeah. Betty is probably pushing 20. So at least Lancaster Dodd is not sleeping with an underage girl fresh off the Greyhound.
Okay.
And you know, you'd think that Jack Parsons would have seen everything by now. And on paper, he loves free love and the free sex in the velvet robes and the goat's head and the partner swapping. He's into all of it. But now this is the last straw. He has seen his beloved lost to this new charismatic friend, and he is distraught.
Wow.
It starts to affect his work. And in fact, in December of 1945, he comes up with a plan to solve his problem with an Enochian working. I believe this has come up on Omnibus, speaking of alchemy, that the great Elizabethan alchemists and scientists like John Dee believed that they had mystic wisdom that they had received from Enoch, the secret writings of Enoch, the Old Testament patriarch, and that they did all kinds of magic ceremonies based on this. And this was a big part of the Hermetic and esoteric traditions that Crowley is drawing on. And so studying Crowley's own rites, which have drawn from these 16th century Enochian rites, Jack Parsons decides he's going to do a mystical conjuration that will solve all his problems.
So he's sitting there now crying over his goblet of blood, having lost his teenage...
Crying into his goblet of warm lamb's blood.
Lost his teenage sister-in-law to L. Ron Hubbard.
To Lancaster Dodd.
To Lancaster Dodd, sorry.
And we all know how that feels, right? When you've lost your teen sister-wife to science fiction cult leader Lancaster Dodd.
Yeah.
It's a terrible feeling.
It's going to break your heart.
It's one of the worst feelings.
So he turns to Crowley.
He turns to the Enochian wisdom of the 16th century. And those in his lodge or in his little group are not sure what he's working toward. They assume maybe he's trying to conjure some kind of epic revenge upon Lancaster Dodd. Lancaster Dodd himself.
He's out in the garage splattering paint on a giant canvas, and he invents splatter art.
Or maybe to get his child bride back, his child non-bride back. In fact, the results turn out to be at first anticlimactic, but then unexpected. Over 12 consecutive nights from late 1945 to early 1946, he puts Prokofiev violin concertos on the gramophone and performs 11 Crowleyan invocations. You got to do the conjuration of air, the consecration of air dagger, the invocation of wand with material basis on talisman.
I was just doing that the other day.
Well, you probably were, yeah. Because the invocation of wand with material basis appears to be a euphemism here.
Uh-huh.
The wand would be the part of Parsons' anatomy that is being used in the ritual. The material basis appears to be the product of the ritual.
Oh, I Trinity.
So he's masturbating to Satan, basically. Uh-huh. I mean, not Satan, in fact. In fact, to a totally non-satanic deity, to Babylon, not spelled like Babylon with a Y. It's got a second A.
Babylon,
like it's a Harry Belafonte thing. In Crowleyan thought, Babylon is a divine whore, is the words that Crowley would use. She's an ancient, forgotten fertility goddess, symbolized by the cup being the most interesting part of her anatomy, I believe, to thinkers like Crowley. Uh-huh. And she's a blessed spirit because she brings her air of fertility and sexual freedom and new possibility. And she, she's one of the best goddesses you could conjure. And there's an apocalyptic angle too
here. Why was she forgotten? If her cup is so great.
Well, I think from most points of view, it would be because she doesn't actually exist. Okay. There is no authentic historic tradition of a goddess named Babylon.
Are you saying that Crowley's just inventing gods at this point?
Crowley, but yes. He's run out of all the good old gods. He's worked his way through Thoth and Hermes and Baphomet and all the rest. And now his spirit guides are whispering new names to him.
He's got a Boggle game, but all it has is B's, A's, L's, and P's.
I mean, he could be drawing Scrabble tiles out of a bag like they do in Rosemary's Baby. I mean, that's going to be a relevant data point here.
I mean, I should say that this is all happening immediately in the first 6 months after the detonation of the atomic bomb.
That is correct. Do you believe that in fact opened a portal to another world where the older ones reside?
Maybe. But it also has to be, I mean, that in a way is the dawn of, well, the nuclear age, but also it's peak science moment, right? The culmination of science.
Science invented a new mystical thing we can't explain, but it ended war.
Yeah, it ended
war. I mean, it also killed, hundreds of thousands of people.
It invoked the god of war.
Exactly. And so now we're at the cusp of a new era where who knows how these uncontrollable, chaotic new forces will change the universe.
So let's go back to an ancient sex worker.
So let's start jerking off on what was it? I missed the thing. On the talisman. So he's doing these sexualized rites, and he's keeping in touch with Aleister Crowley, who I think is rolling his eyes and, cabling his friends in New York saying, what is with this weirdo in Pasadena? Parsons writes to Crowley, nothing seems to have happened. It's anticlimactic at first. Nothing more than a power outage.
He was looking for some results.
Yeah.
Okay.
He had very high expectations for his Prokofiev plus self-abuse. Mm-hmm. However, then things start to happen. He enlists Lancaster Dodd to be his scribe in the rituals. So Dodd is there. Dodd's famously purple prose is coming in handy for writing down what's happening and suggesting new kinds of conjuration and prayer. On the night of January 14th, Dodd notices a candle has been knocked from his hand. And Dodd calls Parsons over, and they see a brownish yellow light 7 feet tall floating in the kitchen of their Pasadena lodge, which Parsons then banishes with a magical sword. Although Dodd's right arm is paralyzed for the rest of the night. Now, so apparently they do have ritual, as you do.
Oh.
They have ritual swords on hand for whenever a weapon might be necessary in their rites.
See, this makes me feel validated, right? Because I do keep those swords around. And if there were to appear a 7 foot tall golden light in my kitchen.
Now you know what to do.
Well, yeah. Well, I might reach for an umbrella first, but a sword next.
Do not reach for your wand and material basis. That appears to be what makes the problem worse.
Key.
You want the sword in your umbrella stand. The next night, Lancaster Dodd reports that he sees a vision of one of Jack Parsons' enemy. Parsons writes to Crowley, so Dodd attacked this figure, pinned it to the door with four throwing knives with which he is expert.
Say what?
So Dodd is already spreading this kind of self-mythologizing about himself. Oh, yeah, in the Pacific, I got really good at these throwing knives.
Thump, 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 just like pulled throwing knives out and pinned him to a door.
In the same letter, Parsons tells Crowley that Dodd's guardian angel has showed up, a highly developed astral vision of a beautiful winged woman with red hair whom he calls the Empress, who has guided him through his life and saved him many times. Now, remember, at this point, Dodd is just a pulp sci-fi writer.
Yeah.
He has not begun any kind of spiritual religious tax dodge tradition.
Sure.
But he's already calling, he's already reporting that he has a beautiful redheaded guardian angel who is calling in the Archangel Michael to guard us.
Is he also writing letters to Aleister Crowley?
No. Parsons is writing the things that Dodd is reporting. So the implication seems to be that Parsons is not seeing any of these things. Parsons is in charge of the masturbatory part of the evening. And then Dodd is like, oh, good news. Isis is here and she's nude. A hint figure of past partly mistaken operations is visible to her right. So he's already also got this weird technical speak that becomes
Is any of this part of the foundational mythology of Scientology?
Yeah, I think it has to be.
Okay.
A lodge with hidden knowledge where you get better and better secrets of the universe.
Isis is there.
Every time you advance a level. I mean, you can see the history of Gnosticism and Hermetism in the Church of S. He sees a rosewood box. He describes these very ornate visions. A rosewood box with a string of green beads, a string of pearls with a black cross suspended in a rose. This is why you want a
string of pearls.
A pulp sci-fi, exactly. This is why you want a pulp sci-fi writer to be your scribe. They finally get up to their climactic ritual, an operation of symbolic birth. And then they settle back to wait to see what happens. For 4 days, Parsons writes that he experiences tension and unease. Then a few days later, he and the scribe, Lancaster Dodd himself, have driven into the Mojave Desert at sunset. He doesn't mention which substances are involved, but we can assume.
Ketamine.
Perhaps there's some peyote or mescaline involved. Uh-huh. Then suddenly they both sense a feeling of tension snapping. And they get home, and they find at the doorway of their lodge a beautiful green-eyed, red-haired elemental on their doorstep by the name of Marjorie Cameron, who says she is delighted, she is ready to begin participating in their rites. And when Parsons explains to her that he would like her to help him produce a new thelemic messiah, a new homunculus in living form resembling man and possessing those qualities of man which distinguish him from beast, namely intellect and power of soul, but neither begotten nor inhabited by a human soul, a moonchild basically. This is based on a fantasy novel actually that Crowley had written called Moonchild about a mystical rite that produces a homunculus messiah pregnancy.
How is there not a Led Zeppelin song called Moonchild?
There must be.
There isn't.
Parenthesis, homunculus messiah pregnancy.
So is this just a neighbor lady that was attracted by the sounds of screaming, or?
This is LA in the 40s. This appears to be a young girl who wandered off a bus and heard that this is where the sex and drug crazies hang out.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But when it's explained to her what her role will be in these rites, she is very excited. And I think, so it appears that Parsons conjuring has worked. The Babylon working has brought him a woman to replace the one he lost to Lancaster Dodd.
And she's going to produce a moonchild with him.
And with it, they will produce an heir, you know, the kind of a new god that will bring about this new age. So, and remember, they're trying to invoke Babylon, the whore from the Book of Revelation on the great beast. And this is what's going to, you know, they've got, this is now the Omen and Rosemary's Baby trope of we're going to produce the pagan mystic occult child that will bring about the next age.
I'm going to go change some of the information on my Tinder profile because this all reads a lot better than whatever I wrote.
I love, and Parsons kind of, Parsons treats this as a Tinder match.
Uh-huh.
He writes to Crowley, "I seem to have my elemental. She turned up one night after the conclusion of the operation and has been with me since. She has red hair and slant green eyes as specified."
As specified.
Swipe right.
Wait a minute. This is the plot of Big Trouble in Little China.
So they continue to perform. So he continues to perform rites with Marjorie Cameron, now as the cup for his wand. The material basis would appear to be a mixture of his own seed, and because it's a moon child.
Star seed.
Her menstrual blood. A mixing of these appears to be the secret, the thelemic secret that will create the new messiah.
But wait a minute. If she's menstruating, it's going to be very hard for her to create a...
Look, John. Are you not listening? The thelemic messiah is not to be begotten. It will not have intellect or power of speech. It will not be... You know, this is the mystery of the thelemic mysteries of the goddess Babylon that is producing the homunculus insider.
Got it.
So he builds a new altar and they get to work, as it were. And he becomes convinced that he has impregnated Cameron with this new moonchild of the new millennium. Then at this point, the Babylon working will continue with the homunculus. They're going to employ the new angelic language of Enoch, and they're going to open an interdimensional doorway, and the goddess Babylon is coming to Earth. Basically, he wants to open a gate to hell to bring about the last days. And I think your invoking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is right on the money here. And Crowley apparently is aghast by this whole thing. I'm skipping ahead. They put Rachmaninoff's Isle of the Dead on the gramophone.
Sure, nothing heralds the coming apocalypse like Rachmaninoff.
And Hubbard begins to babble about, telling Parsons what to, did I say, sorry, Dodd.
That's consistent. That verb is consistent.
begins to babble to Parsons, telling him what to do. Display thyself to Our Lady, dedicate thy organs to her, dedicate thy heart to her. She shall absorb thee. Thou shalt become the living. Maybe I shouldn't say all this stuff because we're gonna not just anger the you know whats, the church of you know what. We're gonna bring about the new fifth age of Kali Yuga or something. Dodd maybe is having a good time here, having taken Parsons' wife. Now he'll do whatever he says. He makes him gaze into an empty box for an hour and then tell him what sacred design appears.
This does feel like a good time gone awry. I mean, if I were at this party, I think at this point I would start to moonwalk out the back door.
You want to moonwalk away from the moon child?
Yeah, a little.
Crowley writes to his New York office. Apparently Parsons or Ron or somebody is producing a moon child. I get fairly frantic when I contemplate the idiocy of these louts.
So he...
And imagine at this point, Crowley looks a lot like Sidney Greenstreet in mm-hmm. Maltese Falcon. He's just an old British guy, looking down his nose at you. I get fairly frantic when I contemplate the idiocy of these louts.
I mean, he's a nutter, but he's like, these nutters have gone a bridge too far.
Now, as we all know, no moonchild ever appeared in the late 40s.
Do we know that?
Well, that's the interesting part of this. You know, a lot of modern day conspiracy theory and ufology revolves around the idea that that Dodd and Parsons and their new muse, Marjorie Cameron, aka the divine goddess Babylon, actually did open some kind of portal and actually did bring the old ones to our age. And it is the following year that pilot Kenneth Arnold sees the first flying saucer on Mount Rainier. So the dates are not crazy.
Line up, huh?
And if you believe in this kind of strange angel intersectional idea that the alien encounters that are reported today are no different than the mystical encounters with djinn and fairies and burning bushes reported in the past, then, why wouldn't it take a mystical tradition to bring these interdimensional beings to our front door and encourage them to probe our anuses?
I would like just to point out, because I just Googled Marjorie Cameron just to see what was going on, and she is the spitting image of Katharine Hepburn.
Is that right?
She looks just like Katharine Hepburn.
Like Katharine Hepburn, she becomes a movie star. She appears in movies by the avant-garde filmmaker Kenneth Anger, and goes on to become a kind of an occult superstar based on her associations with this Crowleyan movement. Unfortunately, things do not go so well for our man, Jack Parsons.
Oh.
He still has the heart. His heartbreak made him do something crazy, or a series of 11 crazy invocations and masturbatory rituals.
Mm-hmm.
But his head cleared after some of those moments.
Right.
And
that can happen to anybody.
That can happen. And he realizes, what have I done? What have I been looking at here? And in fact, a lot of this comes to a head when Dodd betrays him yet again. Dodd announces a plan, a crazy plan to, buy some yachts in Florida. He's a seafaring man, as we all know.
Sure.
Sail them through the Panama Canal and sell them at a big profit to unnamed California buyers.
But halfway there, he was like, wait a minute.
What if I stay at sea forever and found a self-help movement? Well, what he does, in fact, is he gets all of Parsons' money into this scheme, and then he disappears with both the yachts and Betty, Parsons' child non-bride.
So are you saying that Parsons funded, initially funded the Cherche de la, the Cherche de la Solontologie?
The C of S? I don't know if any of the specific yachts that Parsons' money went to became the same ones that, you know, because Dodd was already a sailor
and
loved the sea.
Right.
So I don't know if any of these are the same yachts, but yeah, the idea, he seems to have been there on the ground floor for this idea that there should be a floating navy of mystical thought and science fiction derring do.
Because at a certain point, the dates are going to tell the story, right? It enters into the historic record at some point.
Yeah, I mean, you have to register.
Come on the other
side.
You
have to register these boats. I feel like this would be your angle on the story. You would get very into the shipping records.
Yeah, making phone calls to
I totally
harbor masters.
I didn't even think about the merchant marine side of this story. So Parsons begins a messy decline, exacerbated by his drug and alcohol abuse, and now as I've hinted, exacerbated by the House Un-American Activities Committee, which is starting to find the idea of. Because he's still trying to work on the fringes of the defense industry and working in labs, and now he's got this connection to a black magic sex cult, which starts to look like a little bit pink in the early 50s.
Does he still have some science in him?
He does. He still wants to make you know he's starting to see it all happen.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Like we're getting close to Sputnik here. Like the Nazi missiles on London suddenly got the American military interested. In rocketry for its own sake, and not just as a way to get airplanes off the ground faster. And suddenly there's so much money to be made in rocketry, it's clear that space is the future and the final frontier.
Sure, no, we got all these rehabilitated Nazis walking around in Pasadena now.
If you can rehabilitate Wernher von Braun, surely you can rehabilitate a guy who used to jerk off onto a goat's head.
To open a portal to a Satan world.
Or to wife swap with Lancaster Dodd. But he insists to the House Un-American Activities Committee that, in fact, Crowleyan thought is the opposite of communism. It's all about do what thou wilt.
Yeah.
It's about the rugged Heinleinian libertarian individualist.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this argument does not convince HUAC, which takes away his, what do you call him? His defense credentials?
Yeah, classified status.
His status, yeah. He loses his quasi-military status.
Oh, what a drag. We need more Satanists in the space program, says Congressman John Roderick.
Would that be the whole of your platform? More Satanists in the space program would be the whole of the law. Betty has now run off with Lancaster Dodd.
Okay.
So now he's lost the love of his life, and so they are founding Scientology together. In fact, Lancaster Dodd and his wife and Betty are now the happy thruple around which the C of S, the coalescing movement of self-help, is beginning to form.
Do they also live in a bungalow in Pasadena?
You have to imagine that they might own one, but spend most of their time in a yacht at Marina Del Rey.
I did not realize that polyamory was going to play such a large role in A, the space program, and B, Scientology.
But in hindsight, doesn't it make sense that any of these charismatic guys they really have one thing on their mind when they start a cult? And it's not...
Life and girlfriend.
I guess they have two things on their mind when they start a cult.
I mean, that's literally the reason you would start a cult.
I think that appears to be at the back. Or at least once they start to get followers and enough of them are sevens or eights, it starts to cross their mind.
In New York 7, cult 8.
Pasadena 7, Marina Del Rey. So, unfortunately, Jack Parsons really is on the downslide at this point. He winds up like bootlegging nitroglycerin. Like delivering offshore smuggling nitroglycerin to unsavory parties.
It's funny because
he wants some of it for his experiments, but he also knows somebody who needs it for, you know, who knows what.
In a Jack Parsons life story, like that's him hitting the skids. But for me, that's my highest ambition.
Well, he's also working as a gas station attendant. He's working at a hospital orderly. It's less glamorous than it seems to be a nitroglycerin smuggler in Pasadena in the early 50s.
John, if I write a science fiction novel, the main character will be a nitroglycerin smuggler for sure.
His story ends abruptly on June 17th, 1952, with an explosion at his home lab.
Oh.
Removing him from from history.
Oh, no. He blew himself up?
He blew himself up. And there's many, even at the time, and now from conspiracy theorists, lots of suspicions of foul play.
Suicide squad.
But in fact, yeah, exactly. This is a guy who's been blowing things up for decades. And he's still trying to make that breakthrough at his workbench with all kinds of unstable chemicals.
Wait, did he blow up the Pasadena bungalow too?
No, at this point, No. At this point, I think he has...
At least the house survives.
He's down on his luck. I'm imagining him in some kind of awful rented room somewhere.
Yeah. Is that Pasadena bungalow like currently occupied by two yuppie lawyers?
I believe it's now condos. I looked this up and it appears to be condos. And I've driven through that part of town accidentally trying to get back on the highway. And yeah, it's almost certainly a lovely gay couple and their cat who have no idea about the eldritch energies that once pulsated there.
Can you imagine? You're just like, wow, every time I wake up in the morning, there's this 7 foot tall brown golden figure in the corner.
What should I do? And these guys don't own a sword is the tragedy.
And that concludes The Babylon Working, entry 088. .RV1703, certificate number 36297 in the omnibus. But Ken, I don't remember the words "the Babylon Working" ever appearing in the show.
I think we did say the Babylon Working.
What is the Babylon Working?
Well, Babylon is the name of the goddess you're trying to conjure, and a working is kind of a chaos magic term for a religious invocation or conjuration.
I see.
It does make it sound kind of quasi-scientific.
Yeah.
We're not doing a spell. Come on.
This is the Babylon.
This is the 20th century. We're in Pasadena. We're doing a working.
A working. Yeah. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. Our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. I've been sneaking on... social media a lot lately.
No.
To follow the
war
in Ukraine. And you texted me the other day in the middle of the night saying, "Get off Twitter!" Exclamation point.
You had just tweeted back at me.
I tweeted at
this,
you.
This is like a, we need an intervention.
First time in 18 months I tweeted at anybody. And now I'm actually faving people's posts sometimes.
No.
Yeah, I am.
No.
I'm clicking fave.
Can't I be your Twitter sponsor? Like, can't you like call me up and be like, "Ken, I'm feeling the urge to post."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "John, don't do it. Don't post."
I need to not post.
No good comes of it.
But anyway, if you want to watch me like jonesing and falling off the wagon, look at John Roderick and see who I've faved recently. See which Ukrainian master sergeant I've faved their post. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can hang out with other futurelings, laughing at our misfortune at any social media place where you put the word futurelings into the search bar. You can mail us actual things, actual items in the post at PO Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155, USA. Ken, it sounds like you were opening a box over there.
You are going to enjoy this. The postcard says Ad Astra per Aspera.
Oh, nice.
Do you know what that means?
Sure.
Do you know anything about this slogan?
Yeah.
All right. I do as well, and I'll tell you what I know.
It's, okay.
It means to the stars through hardship. You'd think it would be the slogan of like NASA or Jet Propulsion Laboratories. In fact, it's the mottos of the state of Kansas. This is a note from Jacob in Lawrence, Kansas, who says that his parents and other civic-minded folks of Beloit, Kansas, in the 80s and 90s, while serving on the art council, used to put on a big Chautauqua festival.
Which, I do like that.
Apparently, Beloit had a Chautauqua park, and they brought back the annual Chautauqua, which was kind of a 19th century TED Talk.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob says he remembers being intrigued by the notion of the original Chautauquas, and he hopes we'll consider it as an omnibus topic. He sent us some period photos of the kinds of concerts and art galleries that were present at the Chautauqua, the Beloit, and, Kansas Chautauquas.
And
of
by
the
period,
80s.
You mean taken in 2004, right at the end of film. Those aren't period like from 1884.
No, but these are from the 80s and 90s when his parents were putting on this arts festival.
Oh, I like it.
I think, let's see what kind of hairstyles we see here.
You know, per Aspera 90s, Ad Astra is more than just the motto of the state of Kansas. It's a...
Well, it comes from classical times, I assume.
But it's used as the motto of many entities.
For example?
Well,
I mean, there was recently that Ad Astra film with Brad Pitt, which...
The Duchy of Mecklenburg-Schwerin.
Oh, of course.
Uses it.
Do you think Kansas stole it from the Duchy of Mecklenburg-Schwerin?
Probably they got it from the city of Gouda in the Netherlands.
That's the motto of Gouda?
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't that be like to the cheese through hardship?
It's the motto of the Department of Civil Aviation in Thailand. It's the motto of the National Defense Academy of Latvia. Also, the House Order of the Vendish Crown.
It is the canonical only Latin phrase known by Garrison Keillor in his Prairie Home Companion persona.
It appears in To Kill a Mockingbird and A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.
Do you know the band Acceptance? Seattle pop-punk band Acceptance?
Yes, I do.
Did you know they have a song called Ad Astra Per Aspera, or possibly Per Aspera Ad Astra?
Nice.
Anyway, but in addition, this is what you're going to like. Jacob sent us a bunch of period Chautauqua buttons every year from the Beloit, Kansas Chautauqua.
What's the oldest one?
Well, like the 80s and 90s. Let me see.
Now, our international listeners would call these badges.
Oh, right. These are not buttons. This is a 200th. This is a bicentennial of the Constitution, so that's got to be 87. 86.
That's when I graduated from high school. I like the look of that.
I think you will really... Oh, I'm sorry. I just threw it on the floor. I think you will really enjoy the...
Oh, I do.
The homemade Boy Scout vibe of these badges or buttons. Thank you, Jacob.
Thank you, Jacob.
For sending us your collection of Chautauqua. And have you been thinking about doing a Chautauqua show for years like I have?
I have.
Someday, Jacob. Someday, after hot air balloons.
And finally, if you love Omnibus, as we know you do, and if you want to support the show, we do not typically support the show by conjuring ancient sex goddesses. We do not have our own rocket program yet.
I'm against both those things.
We have not.
I'm against sex goddesses and rockets.
We have not started a phony religion / self-help movement yet.
Yet. But it does appear to be very profitable.
See, that's what I'm saying.
Even with only a handful of members, 25,000 members worldwide, you can still make a go of it, as long as some of them are in the Mission Impossible movies.
As long as at one point you bought a lot of real estate in Los Angeles. But you can help support the show and help us get our crazy schemes off the ground by supporting us at patreon.com/omnibusproject. There are a lot of benefits that come associated with supporting the show.
Wait, what are we doing? Why are we not revealing secret knowledge at every increasing level of Patreon support?
We could start doing that.
We absolutely
could. You and
I
have so much secret knowledge.
What would it be, though? Like, what is actual... Because it would have to be good secret knowledge. Like, we would actually have to say... you know, like at the problem is you've confessed everything on a podcast already. We can't be like,
not everything.
At the $5 level, John will tell you about every Halloween costume he's ever worn. At the $10 level, he'll tell you about his first kiss.
You know, at the $10 level, I will read a chapter from a Harlan Ellison novel every month, and I will leave in all the problematic parts.
I love how you correctly assume who our average listener is.
Hey, there's so many people that are like, would he really do that?
Hey, weird 58-year-old men who have been to science fiction conventions.
I would sign up for that.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. At this point, I think the city of Gouda would wish you many goods and cheese.
They would.
But instead, if providence allows, we wish that you'll be back with us soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily.
Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.